Hello, everybody. Just a very quick one about Instagram. If you're on it, Meta, the parent company, is reducing the number of political posts visible to users on their feed. This is a real thing, not a hoax. So go to your Instagram profile, tap the three horizontal lines in the top right corner to open the settings tab, scroll down to what you see, click on content preferences, open political content, and turn on don't limit political content. That's an option. Otherwise, you won't see almost anything we post because we are deemed political. Please do that now, or you won't even see the posts about our shows, our fun things. So if you want to see Guilty Feminist content and know when we're coming to a place near you or releasing a new podcast, do it now.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm a feminist. But I watched the show The Traitors, and I thought, this is just like comedians, and often female comedians, at the Edinburgh Festival. We're all just talking about each other behind each other's backs, pretending we hope that the other people do really, really well, but secretly being upset when they do and feeling it should have happened to us and that we should have won the money.
I don't do that, I swear.
No.
I'm 100% faithful.
Hey, just give us a cheer if you watched The Traitors or you know about it. Yeah. It was a show where they put all of these people into a house, made them do tasks to win money, but two of them were told they were traitors, or three of them were told they were traitors, and Claudia Winkleman told them they were traitors. And then they had to secretly, while they were earning the money with everyone, at night they'd go up to a tower in cloaks in a castle in Scotland and go, who are we going to kill off in the night? A bit like one of those games.
High stakes, wink murder.
Yeah, exactly. And then they started to feel guiltier and guiltier because they were really genuinely bonding and making friends. They started feeling guilty about being traitors.
Fantastic television.
Oh, such good television. Did you not think this is a lot like the Edinburgh Festival? The way people go, I mean, I liked her show, but I don't think it was a 5-star show. I think it was a solid show, but it's just weird to me that would be nominated. And I wish her well. I really, really do want her to do well. I love her, but I just didn't think, actually, sometimes she is a bit tricky as well, and I'm not sure the message of the show is very feminist. And then she comes up into the bar, and immediately that same person who's been saying that goes, oh, hi, well done on the nomination. Oh, God, I can't believe it's so well-deserved.
We're not even allowed to kill each other.
No, we can't vote each other out of Edinburgh. That's the other thing. I'd like to say I don't go around doing that. I'm just saying, over the years in Edinburgh, you end up in a lot of conversations.
That
where
gave
people
me anxiety.
I felt that.
I was back there.
I'm not saying I do. I'm just, that's made it sound now like I'm a real bitch, and I'm not. I don't do it. But
you
I'm
did
just,
know the speech off by heart.
I'm just parodying the kind of thing that sometimes happens. You go. You say.
Which of these? What do I pick? I'm a feminist, but ever since I came out as non-binary, I do think that I'm slightly less good at making sandwiches.
Ha ha ha! Do you think so?
That's the one I'm starting with.
Do you think you've just lost the feminine urge to make a sandwich?
Yeah, lazier with it, I think.
Well, I don't blame you. If ever I've had a good argument to go non-binary, it's that. Please don't write in, I know that you don't go non-binary. That was a joke.
Do you want to go non-binary? I'll pay.
That was a comedy joke of comediness for laughings. It wasn't for seriouses. I'm a feminist, but this week I've been enjoying reading one-star reviews of feminist classics on Goodreads. Delighted to tell you that both The Handmaid's Tale and The Bell Jar have a lower rating than my book. Not making that up. The Bell Jar has a 4.04. I was saying to Sarah backstage, I was saying, the thing is, the only people who go on Goodreads either go on to say, this is an amazing book, 5 stars, or this is a terrible book, 1 star. And so that means everything, virtually every book has a 4-point-something rating. The Bell Jar, 4.04, Sylvia Plath, sorry. The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood, 4.13. The Guilty Feminist, Deborah Frances White, 4.18, baby!
A feminist victory. I'm a feminist, but I think it's creepy when men play netball.
Fully not okay.
It's the bibs. Creepy little bibs.
I'm a feminist, but while I enjoyed reading 1 stars of my own book on Goodreads, I've not got the courage to read any 3-star reviews. I only read the 5s and the 1s. Because the 1s are funny, right? The 1s are, this is boring, don't waste your time. You're welcome.
You can dismiss.
Right. The 3 stars are by critical thinkers who have actually probably quite excellent points that I should take on board. And I'm obviously scared to do that. I'm scared to learn.
Let's do it.
I'm scared. I will, but I've got to have a lot of fortitude. I'll have to be feeling really good when I read those 3-star reviews.
Vodka tonic out here.
I'm not going to do it now. I'm not reading my own bad reviews live on stage.
It's like, I'm not going to peer pressure you into it.
It's like a nightmare where you walk to school naked. Where a nightmare in which Sarah Keyworth forces me to read my own mediocre reviews on stage.
Nice loud voice, Deborah.
Oh, maybe I've had a nap and I've missed the show and I'm like trying to fight myself awake. Go on.
Okay, I'm a feminist, but a couple of years ago when my girlfriend and I got stuck driving through a snowstorm and we thought we were going to die, I called every man I know. What do we do, Daddy? I think I said those words. And I was talking to her dad.
Enjoyable. Did any of the men help?
They all had advice, of course they did.
I mean, they all had advice, but was any of that advice helpful? Because I find men in those situations always just immediately launch confidently.
You can hear them wanting
advice.
To drive the car, can't you?
Yeah.
The phone.
Yeah, they launch confidently.
Here's what I do.
But they don't always know any fucking thing.
Yeah, the dads did help, to be fair.
Oh, all right. Well, as long as they actually helped.
Yeah.
I mean,
didn't need to call her ex-boyfriend, but...
Wow. Wow. Did you really call her ex-boyfriend?
I'm kidding. Okay. Comedy.
There's something in your eyes that tells me...
Showing off.
I'm a feminist, but my favourite... my favourite review of The Bell Jar was, I only had to read it once. I never read it for or with pleasure. I prefer childbirth. I prefer childbirth. It's good, isn't it? It's good. You can see why I've been distracted from feminism this week.
Yeah, and the problem with The Bell Jar is that you don't sort of forget how awful it is and try and go again.
No, that's true, actually. Yeah. With childbirth, apparently that happens.
But... Yeah, a bit of euphoria at the end, I hear.
Mm. I wonder if there are any reviews of childbirth online. Presumably there are.
There are.
Live from King's Place in London, the Spontaneous Shop presents The Guilty a cheer if you listen to The Guilty Feminist. Give us a cheer if you don't know what you're at. Oh, lots of people. Usually there's only a few people who go, yay. And I always think those cheers sound less feminist. But tonight, lots of people. Now, just to be clear, this show is an official sellout, but there are people who would not leave the bar without a drink. And normally, I don't know, they just close the bar and say, well, there's no more drinks till the interval. But apparently this crowd were rabid. And they did not dare, close the bar before everyone had a drink. I don't know what's happening out there, but I feel like whatever is happening, feminism is working. Because there were some angry feminists out there who said, we will miss the beginning of the show before we will go alcohol-free. And I don't know what's happened to Dry January, but it's not taken hold amongst the guilty feminist community. Just give us a cheer if you're doing Dry January. Oh, just some people in the back row. Do it. Give me a cheer if you're doing Moist January. Give me a cheer if you're doing Very Wet January. I am. I just don't think January needs a lack of alcohol. I feel like I try July, I can see so many lovely things about July. It's sunny, picnics outside, seeing old friends, people. You know, I can absolutely just have a little bit of a cranberry and sparkling water or something in July. I wouldn't even notice I'm having such a nice time in July. But if ever a month needed a fucking drink, it's January, isn't it? Yes! Christmas is over. There's nothing more about winter to look forward to. And yet it intends to drag on well into March. Why? Why? If you live in the Northern Hemisphere, why the fuck would you allow January to be alcohol-free if the rest of your year was not that? Now, the people that don't drink all year round, well done you. You presumably have other coping mechanisms that we don't know about. You've developed them, and I admire it. Just give me a cheer if you never drink. Excellent, excellent. You sound happier, and yet I'm not interested in being you. I'm not actually a huge drinker. I'm saying, making this out like I'm a huge drinker. I'm not a huge drinker at all. I'll drink, like, you know, a couple of vodka sodas a couple of times a week. But those are the... That's not a big drink. A couple of vodka sodas a couple of times. That doesn't sound like a big drinker to me. A couple of vodka sodas a couple of times a week. I mean, are you laughing because you think that's lying? Feels like you're judging me. You're like, it's not a couple and it's not a couple of times a week. That's the kind of thing she'd say if it was two bottles of wine seven nights a week. That's not a couple of nights. But I need those. When I want one, I want one, okay? And January is a month, frankly, a month that can go fuck itself at the best of times. Much less with this added dryness on top. So if you've got a drink tonight, well done. If you're someone who has quit drinking and this has made it much more difficult for you, I'm so sorry, I've just realised that probably wasn't tactful. If you're doing Dry January and now you're thinking, fuck it, I'll have a drink in the interval, don't do that, don't do that. This is just comedy. I don't want to railroad your life. You're so close, it's the 26th, you're nearly there, keep going, keep going, keep going. I will not help you, but I won't buy you a drink either, okay. Just let me know if you've, just give me a cheer if you've done anything feminist since January 1st, this is 2023, anyone done anything feminist in 2023? People are thinking it through. Okay. You're doing that like you went to a feminist rave. You're going, I have been asking for a small act of feminism that would intimidate nobody, just so other people are reassured and go, well, I can do better than that. Do we have a very mini act of feminism? Yes. What's yours?
I review a lot of letters.
Oh, you review a lot of letters. Hold on, I might just give you the mic, because this sounds like it's going to be good. I've never had one before that starts with, I review a lot of letters. Normally they start with, I left my husband at home with the children tonight and deliberately didn't tell him where anything was because he should know by now. You know, things like that. And I've turned my phone off. I hope he's having a terrible time. Things like that, people say. But this starts with, I review a lot of letters, and I already don't know what that means, and I'm excited to find out.
It's very small. So I review a lot of letters, and a lot of them start Dear Sir Madam and refer to he, she, and I change it to whom it may concern and remove all gender references.
So when you
When you say you review letters, do you mean you work for a company where letters are being posted out?
Yeah, it's HMRC. Yeah.
It's HMRC.
So they go to
HMRC. To HMRC. For our international listeners.
The tax authority in the
UK. Yes. Okay. So your company sends letters to HMRC, and sometimes people say, "Dear Sir, Madam," and you say, "To whom it may concern," and just generally feminist up the letters a little bit. Yeah. Does anyone know you're doing that? Because I think that first part, "To whom it may concern," that's fine to make that more feminist. The actual content of the letter to HMRC, making it more feminist, like, "I'd like to pay double my tax, but only if it goes to the following causes." That could be a cause for alarm in your company. So I was going to ask your name. I won't now, because I want that to go on. Anyone else done a small act of feminism? Yes?
I called out a guy at work that was saying that men should be strong all the time.
You called out a guy at work who said men should be strong all the time. And it's a man's job to be strong.
Yeah, I was very angry.
You were very angry, yeah. Where do you work?
In the NHS.
At the NHS? Yeah. You work for the NHS? And who was saying that a man should be strong all the time? Because people are flooding to the NHS in some cases is because of the anxiety that we take on, and particularly men feel like they have to bottle all their feelings up because of patriarchal forces in the history of the world. So this is an absolutely terrible thing to be saying. Can I ask what his role was?
It's a psychiatric ward.
It's a psychiatric ward. Holy McFoley, this story's taken a turn. It's a psychiatric ward. Forensic psychiatric ward. Holy, holy, holy. Frick on a stick. Bloody hell. Go on. And so who was he? He was talking to a work guy who was fixing a light bulb. And he, just to be clear, he's not a patient. Because if so, I think probably you getting very angry at him isn't helping the problem. No, he works there. Is he a doctor?
No, he's a support worker
who says men should have to be strong the whole time in a psychiatric unit for the NHS. He's also married and likes to flirt. And each time you say, "Would your wife like that?" So every time he flirts with you... So he comes over to you and he's like, "Hey, baby, I think men should be strong. Do you like a strong man? Do you like a strong man? Do you like a strong man?" And you say, "Number one, no, I'll enjoy a vulnerable man who understands what his strengths and weaknesses are and is comfortable in all of his humanity. And two, I've got your wife on speed dial now. Back the fuck off. Back the fuck off. Support work on my ass." Oh, this is excellent work. This is that's proper feminism there, isn't it? That's just doing the Lord's work. Has anybody got something that a feminist project they need help with? Anything they need help with? Anything you're doing? Are you doing like a project? Have you got a petition? You got anything you'd like us to help with? You're waving up the back.
About Andrew Tate's following amongst young boys in schools today. Alert your schools about that. Ask your daughters if they hear from their friends at school that they follow Andrew Tate or someone of the kind.
Oh, okay. So you go into schools to talk about Andrew Tate?
No, I don't.
I've
alerted my daughter's school, but I'm saying here to any mothers.
To parents, yeah. To alert their schools whether or not boys are being radicalised in the schools by misogynistic YouTubers.
Exactly.
Okay. So just in general, parents, be aware. It's an awareness programme of see if parents can talk to schools and say, "Hey, do you know if this is being talked about in the playground? Keep an ear out." Okay. Interesting. Interesting. Anyone else got anything they need help with? Yes? What's yours?
Hi. So, not one for me, but I follow this lady called Jolie Bailey, and she is a force of nature, and she looks for volunteers for people from the HR family to help women who get discriminated for having children. And she is, one, constantly looking for volunteers. So Joy Bailey is the name that you look for in search online. And secondly, she is petitioning to the cabinet for a better child subsidized thing. And she's got some sort of survey going. So all the mums out there, please fill it. Give your angry views.
Great. Okay. So parents, give your views. And it's Jolly Bailey. So get involved, because it sounds like she is doing some hardcore work in equality. Thank you so much. All right. Are we ready to start the podcast? Then please welcome to the stage my incredible co-pilot for this evening, the one, the only, the you've seen her off the telly, Sarah Keyworth.
How y'all doing?
We're doing okay. We're doing okay. So, Sarah, how are you? Have you had a guilty week or a feminist week?
Guilty.
Have you?
Yeah, probably.
Are you just thinking about all the things you've done this week?
Yeah, I'm thinking about them. I don't know why I'm flirting with you. I was just... Would your wife like that?
Enjoyable, enjoyable. No, I'm delighted. I'm absolutely delighted with any and all flirtation that I can get.
I've had a bit of a guilty week, I suppose. I tried to do Dry January. My girlfriend and I tried to do Dry January.
How'd that go?
Day 10, she was addicted to cannabis oil.
Oh, yeah, that'll happen.
I had to stop that.
Substituting one
for drinking
other.
Wine again. If I hadn't done it, she'd be doing heroin by now, I think.
Yeah.
Had to intervene.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that Dry January is going so well. Have you given up now?
Yes, completely given up. Don't worry. I'm not sober.
There's a few people doing it. Just give us a cheer if you started doing it and now you're no longer doing it. Yeah, there's a few people.
Those are my people. Slurring their woos.
This is The Guilty Feminist, the podcast in which we explore our noble goals as 21st century feminists and our hypocrisies and insecurities, which... Thank you. I'm Deborah Frances White. With me is Sarah Keyworth, and we are talking about death. That doesn't sound like a very cheerful subject, but it is a feminist one, I think, and we have got an incredible guest. I feel very, very lucky to have her, because at the moment she's on all of the television shows, she's going everywhere because she's talking about her book. Many of you will be fans of her and fans of her podcast. Her podcast is called Griefcast, and her name is Carrie Ann Lloyd! So we're going to talk about the feminist issue of grieving and also life itself, but it will be done in a way that's sort of wraparound. I don't think it doesn't need a trigger warning, because Carrie Ann's so good at talking about it. So wherever you are in the space around grief, Carrie Ann's just like an expert at talking about it. Sarah and I aren't experts, but we'll do our best.
Trigger warning when I open my mouth, I say. Just blanket.
Just a blanket trigger warning.
Trigger warning every time I open my mouth.
If Sarah gets the microphone...
Close your eyes and your ears.
Okay. In that case, are you ready for some stand-up comedy? Please welcome to the stage Sarah Keyworth!
Hello, hello. Big, big year. Big year for me this year. Going to break up with my therapist. That's the plan. Because I've been seeing her for about a year and a half now, and I've realised that she knows everybody in my life so well, and I've told her almost everything, that we're not doing therapy anymore, we're doing gossip. And you have to end it with your therapist when she says the words, "Oh my God, she did not say that." The other day I mentioned somebody that I'd never mentioned before, and she wanted an Instagram to see what she looked like. It's an absolute nightmare. I'm not very good at therapy. I'm just going to start my watch so I know how much, because I could talk to you all night. But therapy doesn't suit me in any way. I think I made a big discovery early on. I'm too northern to have it, in that it's so expensive, and that makes me so angry that it negates any of the therapeutic practice I might receive during the process. I'm not even northern. I'm from Nottingham, but I think that's north enough. To be too northern for therapy. It's so expensive. My therapist, her name's Hazel, she charges me £60 an hour, and the conversion rate is too easy on that, isn't it? £1 a minute, that? And I think about that with every passing second. She likes to do 5 minutes of breathing at the top of each session. That is £5 of breathing. I can't afford that. I can breathe for free at home, Hazel. I need help. There was one day she sneezed, it cost me 25p. one of the reasons I went to therapy was to talk about my friend Paul. Paul, funniest person I've ever met in my life. Paul, so funny. During the pandemic, I wasn't able to go and see him. Obviously, we were all in lockdown and stuff. So to cheer me up, what he did was he made me a game. And what he did was he sent me this photograph of a really busy beach. And within the photograph, he'd photoshopped a dick pic. The game was called Where's Willy? And in a move that we both agreed was incredibly on brand, I never found it. Genuinely, I couldn't find it. I rang him up. I was like, I'm completely dick blind. I can't do it. I'm too gay. I said, I found 7 vaginas. He was like, didn't put any in there. I was like, I think you find you did. The reason I had to go talk to Hazel about Paul is because about this time last year, he passed away. He died. He died in February last year. And it was a shock. It was a big shock. Shouldn't have been a shock because he told me. He did tell me a few months before he passed away. He said, I think I'm going to die. But he was so funny. I did think he was joking. I did. I thought he was kidding. I said, oh, that's a good one, Paul. And he said, well, I'm not kidding about it. And I was like, great stuff. Going to put that in my show. And he was like, I'm not joking. And I was like, get. And I thought it was really good stuff. It was very, very funny. But it was a shock. And it was hard. So I've been talking to Hazel about it, been trying to deal with it. And I was talking to her about how it was making me feel. And I was like, this has been really tough. And I don't know how to go to work. I don't know how to do my job now that I'm grieving like this. It's the first time I've ever had bereavement like this, and I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to go to work. I used to write with Paul. I used to write comedy with Paul, and I don't know how to do that now that that person that made my life so joyful, made my job so joyful, isn't here anymore. And she was just like... yeah. That's tough. And it was really with a tone of like, you know, you should speak to somebody about this. And then she was just silent for like a pound 10. And it's not just her. I know, it's very hard. She doesn't know what to do. I think she's bad at her job, really. But she doesn't know what to say. And it's hard. It is really hard. My girlfriend found it very hard because she wasn't grieving and she didn't know Paul in the same way. And that dynamic is very difficult. If you're grieving and you're around people that aren't grieving, that's really hard because you can't feel it. When you're in it, you can't feel it if you're not in it, which is a nice thing. But grieving, when you're around people that aren't grieving, is like being on a night out with all your friends, you've lost your phone, all your mates are on ecstasy, and you're trying to explain to them that you've lost your phone. And they're all just there like... oh, no! Oh, well, that sucks! Oh, I love this song! You can't feel it. You can't feel it if you're not in it. It's very hard. And I've never known grief like it. Losing a friend at a young age is a big shock. And I thought I'd experienced grief. I've lost people before. I've like, you know, lost grandparents, things like that. Grandparents. I'm going to say something. You're not going to agree with it, but I'm going to say it. I think grandparents. Are a bad concept. I think they're a bad idea, and I don't know why we do it, to be honest. And you're looking at me like you don't. I don't. Okay, I'll explain. My grandmother, I loved her so much. She was amazing. My grandmother, she was 81 when I was born. Why did they introduce us? What a ridiculous thing to do. When I'm a grandparent, I'm going to be fantastic. I'll go once. I'll go on the first day. I'll meet the baby once. I'll walk into the hospital and I'll go bend over, meet the baby once, and I'll say, don't waste your time loving me. And then I'll walk into a fire. Which, admittedly, might be harder for the baby to deal with in later life. I'm sure there are therapists that are slightly more adept at dealing with the my grandmother passed away peacefully of old age trauma than the my grandmother committed honour suicide on the day of my birth. But I've made my choice and I'm sticking with it. I was pretty lost, I think. I was lost. Doing my job was hard. It's very difficult to do my job. Because I wrote with Paul and it was very... difficult to get up on stage, and there was routines of mine that I found it very difficult. I'd get really emotional sort of going through them because it'd be hard to do. And the worst part about that was because he was so funny, it was always my stupidest routines that I would get emotional during. Like, shortly after he died, I cried at a gig in Market Harborough because I was doing a routine about the fact that I don't wear white pants because I can't handle the truth. All right, okay, there are two types of people in the world that wear white pants, okay? There are people with abnormal... this is white underwear I'm talking about, white underwear right now. There's people with abnormally clean bums. Abnormally clean bums. Or it's people who are so brave they are willing to accept whatever the underwear has to show them at the end of the day. And you're all looking at me like I'm completely disgusting, and I'm not disgusting in any way, so don't look at me like that. I'm not saying that. I don't get home at the end of each day and take off my pants and read them like tea leaves. That's what I'm saying. I'm not there like, oh man, it looks like I'm coming into money, you know. So I said all of that, crying in Market Harborough. And the problem with those jokes is that if you say them whilst crying, it does look like you've shit yourself. Thank you very much. Cheers. Please welcome to the microphone, Deborah Frances White.
So I've already talked about the death of my father on Griefcast, and I'm sure I've talked about it on here in the past. So the only thing I'll tell you is I went to the doctor and said, can I have some Prozac, because I can't get past this. And the doctor said, you're not meant to feel good. Your father's died. That's why Victorians wore black for a year. And I said, rich Victorians did. Poor Victorians got back down the mine or up the chimney, and I'm one of those. Give me the Prozac. She said, fair enough. Genuinely a conversation I had about the death of my father. But I've already talked about that, so tonight I've written something specifically for this about my own death. It's fine. It's fine. Relax. I imagine my own death 3 to 7 times a week. If I cross a road and it's not completely clear, I can imagine everything from my nearest and dearest getting the news to my own funeral, and how long it would take for my husband to remarry, and how much he'd realise that the second woman was better than me in around 25 seconds. I've genuinely got that down. It's just like almost like a flash. You know when they say, you know, life flashes before your eyes? My death flashes before my eyes all the time. It happens, I would say, 3 to 7 times a week. If the people around me are having a hard time at the moment, I think about how I can't die and leave them having a difficult time, arrogantly assuming my presence is really doing anything at all. If everyone in my life is doing okay, I think more about the me of it all. How much they'll miss me, not because they need me, but because I like to imagine I'll leave a hole. The truth is, life goes on and people laugh at your funeral like bastards. Have you ever been to a funeral? People laugh. People eat sandwiches. People eat fucking sandwiches. When I'm dead, people will go to my funeral and say, where are the sandwiches? Like, it absolutely doesn't matter. People who love me dearly, people who call me up and want stuff from me, oh yeah, those same people will be looking for the sandwiches at my funeral. I've done it. I've been to other people's funerals. I've cried. I've loved those people. But at the end of the day, I've eaten the sandwiches. I've in fact complained that there weren't enough sandwiches. Sandwiches have run out. I've complained about a lack of sandwiches at someone's funeral who I loved. But life has to go on, and sandwiches have to go on. This is the tragic thing about it. People often say, don't wear black at my funeral. I want a celebration of my life. Not me. Please wear black. I want it to look like Paris Fashion Week. I want everybody fully in black. I would like people crying, wailing. I don't want people laughing and have a good time. I don't want it to be a celebration of my life. I want it to be a mourning of my death. That's why they call it a funeral. I want some funny speeches, though, to reflect that I was funny. But please laugh through your tears. It will be an open funeral. If you've bothered to come to this show, turn up to my fucking funeral.
And when, you know, people like Sarah Keyworth are speaking about me, they'll be funny, of course, because Sarah's funny, she can't, but it's what we want, it's a comedian's funeral, all of that. Laugh through your tears. I don't just want, like, laughter. I want tragic laughter. I want you to be choked up. What I do want, actually, is a Guilty Feminist memorial show at the London Palladium. I think I'll also have one at the Sydney Opera House and one at Vicar Street in Dublin, because they're my favourite sort of venues, the hot spots. If I've cracked America by then, one in New York, please. I mean, at the moment, it wouldn't be well enough attended and I wouldn't want that, but I'm not intending to die soon, so one of my things is to crack America so I can have a New York memorial show. It's one of my biggest motivators, to be honest, is my memorials. These shows can be funny with minimal tears, unlike the funeral. Ideally, I will be elderly at this point and close to death, but not actually dead. And this is true. I intend to fake my own death by putting it on Wikipedia and Twitter, because that's all people look at. Then there'll be obits, right? Okay, people will believe I'm dead. And then I will turn up at all of these memorial shows as a mysterious stranger in a black hat and a veil, alone in a box. Not a coffin, a theatre box at the theatre. I want music and comedy, and finally to realise my dream of a feminist magician who puts a man in a box, cuts him in half and leaves him there. Not a theatre box, a magic box. The reason I think we get these flashes about our death is because life is short. But is it short? I sometimes think it's not really. It can be, because some people's lives are short, but it, you know, I suppose a butterfly thinks its life feels about the right. It feels long to a butterfly. I think our lives actually, well, certainly can be long. Life can be long. I don't think life is short so much, but I think life is flammable. When you've seen death, it is like a magic trick. Like, now you see it, now you don't. That person's just gone. And that knowledge of having seen death, it makes me appreciate my own warm, beating, under-exercised heart and my moving, friendly, imperfect limbs. And it makes me think of the previous inhabitants of London, where I live. Like in the 1920s, people like Tallulah Bankhead, Radcliffe Hall, the Bloomsbury Set, Virginia Woolf and all her mates, imagining in the 20s, as they must have, that they would be young and the centre of action forever and ever and ever, like we do now. Imagining on our good days that ageing and death won't happen to us, except in a sort of melodramatic way, with like a plane crash and an extra funeral, that sort of thing. We sort of think of those, but we just don't think of getting old and then it won't be our turn anymore. So I like to remind myself of all the people who've ever lived, and all the people who are yet to live, it's our turn now. We're having a turn. We're young, we're relevant, we're in the conversation. We can change what happens next. So the reason I sometimes like to think about death and grief is because it reminds me of how very alive I am this week, at least so far. Thank you very much.
What kind of sandwiches?
Well, I mean, I should say vegan because I'm always trying to be more plant-based. I've just realised that I think there's a sort of chill bit under this dress which I think was hitched up. Did it look odd?
No, I didn't know.
Did it? No, okay, thank you.
No? Be honest.
Because if I have an open casket, could someone make sure that the skirts were pulled down?
Pulled down?
Yeah.
Pulled down?
Yeah.
Can we make a note of that?
Yeah.
Definitely down. You're going with down.
Can you imagine an open casket with my skirt up over my face?
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Everyone will be talking about it.
The absolute horror.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much.
But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Guilty Feminists. This is Deborah with some quick announcements. We have more shows coming up at King's Place on the 17th of March and at Soho Theatre on the 24th, 25th and 27th of March. Get your tickets now by going to guiltyfeminist.com and clicking on live shows. Jessica Regan is back with more big speeches workshops to help you find your voice. These will take place via Zoom and will be on the last Sunday of the month, starting on the 26th of March. The cost is £50, but we have subsidised £10 places available if you can't afford that. Link in the show notes or go to guiltyfeminist.com and click on Big Speeches. If you want to support the podcast, you can go to patreon.com/guiltyfeminist, and from as little as £2.50 a month, you get ad-free episodes, bonus content, and you can be the first to hear about new shows and get special discounts. And something that costs you nothing to do is go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star review and click follow or subscribe. Also, share an episode you particularly enjoyed with someone either online or tell someone with your face who might like to listen to The Guilty Feminist. And now, back to that very same podcast.
Our guest today is a comedian, actress, writer and improviser. And author. She is the creator and host of the award-winning podcast Griefcast, and in her new book, You Are Not Alone, she provides a roadmap for grief inspired by her own mistakes and lessons and from the profound and witty insights of her incredible guests. Please welcome to the stage the incredible Carrie Adlai! Hello and welcome.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me. Can I just open?
Please enjoy a can of water. This is a recyclable can of water because we're
really thirsty and I didn't bring water. And oh, I just kept watching you drinking it.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Should we all have a little sip now, everybody?
Yeah. Okay. Everyone have a little sip. Okay.
Some people. Not of my water, like of your own drinks.
Carriad.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about You Are Not Alone?
I can, but I've got this thing where if something's occurred to me, I have to say it out loud.
Yeah,
do you have
on.
This? And when she said Jolie Brearley, the organisation is Pregnant Then Screwed, which is what you should look for. And that's been driving me mad.
I wondered if it was that.
Pregnant Then Screwed. Because if you search Jolie, she doesn't use her name.
Okay. Pregnant Then Screwed. Everyone, look up Pregnant Then Screwed on Twitter and Instagram. Thank you so much.
Sorry. Now, anyway.
Thank you so much for telling us about that. It's really kind of you.
I immediately started pretending I wasn't on the stage. They'll hear it. They'll know.
I'm sorry that I cannot move past it. It's like in my head. And I was like, if I don't say it, I won't be able to talk to you.
I should ask you how you are first. How you are. Because you've been talking a lot about death lately. Is it all right doing that?
Yeah, it's hard talking about it every day. And I felt like even when you were like, today we're talking about death, there's like 20% of people are like, oh, great. And then I can't do math, so I'm not going to carry on with percentages.
The other would be 80%.
But like some people are like, oh, interesting. No, more than that. So the 20% are like, oh, great, I'm fine with that. 20% are like, I'm neutral. And then what would be left?
60.
Thank you.
I'd go with 60.
Thank you. 60% are like, what? And you can feel this like, oh, God. And so you do feel like slightly like the grief witch coming into town with like...
We do call you that behind your back.
In Edinburgh, yeah. Because you feel like some people are like, great, that's brilliant, I'm really happy to talk about it. And other people are like, oh, God, I don't like, fuck you, I don't want to talk about it. And they, you feel this, like, it's weird. I don't know, you have this with feminism as well. Like, some people just, like, they don't... It's like, well, how dare you bring this into the conversation? You're like, I'm not. Human beings did that themselves with the way they evolved mm-hmm. to die. That's not... I didn't make you die. So, yeah, it is hard to constantly bring it up.
I understand what you mean, because sometimes I feel... Like, I was a comedian and a writer, and then at some point, because I started doing this podcast, yeah. I became, like, a professional woman.
Yes, yeah,
like,
yeah.
I just made, like, a woman for a living.
Yeah,
like,
I'm a professional know. Griever.
People will call me up and go, a woman said something. Could you comment on this?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, but are you...
Why, who?
Nish Kumar because a man said something? Because if not, go away.
Yeah. And they do the same, like, if anyone dies... I get called to talk about how does this country deal with grief? So obviously I was quite busy last year.
Because of the Queen?
Well, Queenie, yeah. They were like, how do we deal with it? And it was really hard not to be like, well, I don't think I can talk about grief unless you deconstruct what's happening in that situation of having a royal family and why that... Yeah, and they didn't want that answer. They didn't want that. They just wanted us to say, it is hard. It's hard. It's hard to grieve.
She was so young.
It's always when they're young, it hits more, doesn't it?
I like the precedent, though, of people queuing to see the coffin, because I should have actually added that into the piece that I wrote.
Yes.
Do you think there could be, at the London Palladium, a casket on the stage and people queue up to see it?
Yeah, open casket, skirt on the head.
The trouble is, it will have to be skirt closed because I'm not really dead in this scenario. I definitely want to go to my own funeral.
Can I play the corpse? Can I be the corpse?
Then the skirt will have to be over your face.
I'm okay with that.
I'll do it. I'll flip it over.
Can you imagine, Sarah, you in this prom dress?
That's not Deborah's vagina.
And then we'll have a visible bit of string. We'll just pull it back down again. It is hard talking about it.
Do other people... I just assumed when I wrote that other people often thought about their own death or had, like, moments you're on a plane and you think, what if I die now? And I'm not a frightened flyer at all, but sometimes you get a bit of turbulence and you just go, what will happen now? What will it be like if
I worry because I have exactly the same thing, but I don't know if we're a good group. As in, like, what do they call it? Case study. Because I feel exactly the same, but I talk about death all the time, so...
Right, okay. You
know, we're not normal. You've picked the wrong team.
Do you ever have this feeling, this flashes?
Yeah, some are nodding, some are shaking their head. I think it's pretty 50-50, probably. Some people just aren't willing to face it. Some people are running away from life. I think about it all the time, but I did even before the grief cast. But then my dad died when I was 15, and what quite happens quite a lot, if you lose a parent or someone significant as a teenager, you develop death anxiety.
Right.
Because you lost someone very important. So then, and my therapist said it to me once, she was like, you've got this thing called death anxiety, not everyone is going to die. And I was like, yeah, but someone did. Like, in terms of evidence-based.
Also, everyone's going to die.
Yeah.
Everyone is.
But she meant, like every day. She was like, not everyone's going to die, like, all the time.
You always worry about untimely death.
Yeah, I'm just... Well, if anybody calls me, I think, someone's died. Like, they're telling me someone's died. That's why they're ringing. Like, that would be my instant thought if anybody rang. Who's died? I'm not alone. There's a few. You are not alone, guys. Don't make me feel alone. The book's called...
I definitely do that. I do that a bit. I think...
And if I'm crossing a road, definitely, I always think, car's going to hit me. The irony, if it does after the show, that'll be...
Oh, this would get so many listens, though, wouldn't it? Her last public appearance.
Yeah.
Be great for us, wouldn't it? Our careers.
You could put it out as a memorial episode.
Yeah.
I'm really worried that two people have left. If anybody is finding this hard and you want to leave and you want to get your money back, I will absolutely guarantee your money back. Because if you thought you didn't come here tonight, you're worried about it. I was feeling like the way we were going to talk about it wouldn't trigger anybody, but it might be. So if you need to go, no one will judge you for leaving.
No,
if
it's you're not. It genuinely not at all. Is. Not
no, no. And you can absolutely... I'll give your ticket price back and give you tickets for another show. So if you...
A cheery one. I won't be there, I promise. I promise I won't be there.
Do you want to go? Okay.
Oh, okay. Not related to us talking about.
No, it's not related.
Oh, okay.
To it.
Okay.
Oh, okay. They had to go.
Okay. They just had to. They just didn't think it was funny. Okay, that's fine. It wasn't anything to do with the death. They were just funny.
Oh, okay. Okay. They just hated it. Okay.
Sure.
They had a star. It was a one star. It wasn't a three star. It was just a one star.
No. Oh God! Don't say that.
It's also worth saying, if anybody wants to openly weep during this whole thing, then please just have at it as well.
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing. That's what you're so good at, is letting people feel grief.
Yes.
Could you please tell us about the stages of grieving? Like, you know when people say there's 5 stages of grieving? Can you tell us? Because I've heard you say that this should be debunked.
Yeah.
Can you please debunk it for us?
Okay, so the 5 stages of grief makes me very angry. But if it has worked for you, congratulations, that's brilliant.
Is anger not one of the stages, though?
Yeah. And I did say that in the book. In the book, I talk about it, and it's like, Carrie Ad obviously hasn't moved on from the 5 stages. So if you don't know about the 5 stages, or you've roughly heard of it, it's the idea that when a death happens, you go through 5 distinct emotions, and at the end, you reach a place of acceptance where you don't feel grief anymore. So you go through, and I always get this wrong, so it's anger, denial, depression, bargaining, acceptance. Some of that's probably in the wrong order. And then at the end, you reach acceptance of your grief. And this is kind of really like culturally embedded. Most people know it. If you're not in the club, as we say on the grief cast, often people come up to you and go, oh, well, look, you'll go through the 5 stages and it'll be okay. Which is like, just as a tip, never, ever, 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 you know, Batman slapping Robin, don't ever fucking say that to someone if they're grieving, because it's unhelpful. The reason is, it was written by an amazing woman, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, absolutely fantastic woman. She was one of the founders of the hospice movement. She was working with children who were suffering from AIDS in the 80s before anyone was willing to do that work. So she's an amazing woman. In 1969, she writes a book called On Death and Dying, where she posits this theory. Now, this theory comes from her working in hospitals where people are dying of cancer, terminal illnesses. So, as we know, that's not the only way to die. She's working predominantly with cancer patients. And she says, if you tell a cancer patient that they're going to die, which they weren't at the time, they were just not telling people. They were like, you've got a malignancy. And then they'd give you some medication, say, it's going to help, you'll be better. And then you'd die.
And this is a real feminist issue as well, isn't that? Because you watch something like Mad Men, and you see that they would tell the husband.
Really common.
And they would not tell
the wife.
The woman.
Yeah, yeah. So the woman would be getting treatment, and she wouldn't even know where the cancer was, because they didn't tell you that. They didn't think it was interesting. So they'd just say, you've got malignancy. And they'd say to the husband, she's going to die in 2 weeks. Don't tell her. It will upset her. So then she would be there going, oh, well, hopefully I'll be out in 2 weeks. They've said I'm going to get better. And everyone would be going, like actual gaslighting. So she was working in hospitals where that was happening, clearly not great. So she said, if you tell a cancer patient, someone who's dying of a terminal illness, that they are dying, they will go through 5 distinct stages before they reach an acceptance of their death. So it was never, ever, ever about grieving. It was about dying. And the reason it makes sense for dying is if you're dying, you're about to hit a full stop. You're about to die. So you can accept, okay, you might not, but you can reach a place of, right, I'm going to die, so I'm going to tell you, say these things to my family, tell people I love them, apologise for things, tell people where the money is buried, all those sort of things.
And I suppose if you don't, then you just die and you're kind of in it, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. But if you're grieving, you can't reach acceptance where you don't feel anything, because you're living. You're having to live with grief. So she never said that. She wrote a book which was talking about, and the subtitle of the book is On Death and Dying, How Medical Professions, Vicars and Clergy Can Help People Deal with Their Death.
Right.
Like something.
So it's your own death
that
in a specific context that you can go through those stages.
And that you are not obviously being hit by a car, that you are suffering from an illness and you have time to be told that, and the doctors have time to work with you and accept that. So that's what she was saying.
Would they be the case if, I don't know, somebody was faking their death? Not naming names.
Yes, if that was to happen.
Sure.
They might go through 5 distinct stages, and then they would reach the acceptance that the dress had to be over their face for it to be really funny.
But the acceptance piece doesn't work with grieving.
No.
Specifically because you may never be able to accept the death of your mother, for example, or your child.
Yeah.
So you don't have to get to acceptance.
No, acceptance is... And to be honest, after interviewing nearly 200 people on the grief cast, I have met one person at a time who was like, I'm absolutely fine, I've accepted it. Everybody else said, it still makes me sad, my life has grown around it, I've learned to deal with it, I've learned to carry it, But if you said to me, are you sad that happened? Yeah, I am. I am still sad. And that's what I think with grief, you have to reframe it, because what we usually ask, what we want of people normally is to be like, we want you to get over that grief because it's sad and you're sad. What we don't say is, oh, I'm going to help you learn to live with it, because you will always be sad that your friend isn't here, that your dad isn't here. Like, that will always be something that's painful. So let me help you build a life and give you positive experiences that cheer you up, or let me be there when you're crying and not try and stop the tears. Like, that's the way to help someone, rather than going, 2 years still talking about it. When are you going to reach acceptance? Because then it makes it feel like you can do grief wrong. Like, there's an exam and you're failing it. Mm. And so then the person grieving feels terrible, and they feel terrible because someone's dead. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's just such an unhelpful theory.
What else should we know? Is there anything that you've discovered that all of your interviewees have in common, or many of them have? Like, what can we expect in the book? How can we... Will it be comforting?
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. I've definitely, because I also get sent a lot of grief books. And there's some amazing grief books out there, but there's a lot of kind of books that when they land on your desk, you think, oh, I don't want to read that. Oh, that looks sad. So I have tried to write a book that genuinely, whether you're in the club or not, you can pick up without thinking, oh God, like, I don't want to think about it today. It's very practical. And I said, it's like a map, in that I showed you what grief looks like, but I haven't told you how to, you know, what way you need to go. That's completely personal and unique to your grief. But I have said, well, me and all these other people on the show, this is what they found. But the biggest takeaway genuinely is 5 stages is bullshit. It's just like, let that go. And that there is no right way to grieve. Like, whatever you're doing, if it's helping you, then that's fine, as long as it's not obviously damaging to you in some way. And just to say, because I think when I sort of kick the 5 stages out, it's a bit depressing. Like, oh, well, then what then? There's this amazing theory called dual process model.
Yeah.
Don't you've heard of? By Strober and Schutt, who are these amazing modern grief psychotherapists. Basically, no one thinks 5 stages anymore. So it's not just me. Just in case you think it's just a comedian improviser from North London that's like, that's bullshit. So the dual process model is the idea that when you're grieving, you have 2 states. You've got the grief, which is like proper snot, crying. You're making that noise that sounds like a goose. You don't know who it is. It's you.
I was very surprised when my dad died that because I'd watched Moulin Rouge on the plane on the way over. It was an old movie at the time, but I watched it because it was playing and just sort of something to distract me. And I was like really like hysterical on the plane. But I was just like, you know, watching this movie, and I remember thinking the way that Ewan McGregor cries in that is over the top. And then when my dad actually died, because I had to fly to Australia, and I didn't know if he was still going to be alive when I landed, and he was, thankfully, he sort of held on the way sometimes people can. And when he actually died, I remember sort of sliding down the wall in the hallway of this hospital and doing the Ewan McGregor crying from Moulin Rouge. And I remember thinking, oh, he's not overacting. This is what happens.
That's Ewan McGregor's entire life. People experiencing going, he wasn't overacting.
No, he wasn't overacting. Yeah. Give him an award. At the time, I would have
said he's good, actually. He is good.
Retrospectively.
When your dad dies, you'll finally realise he's good at acting.
Yeah. I also understood Hamlet for the first time.
Oh, really?
Because, you do go mad. You do. Like, you do lose it. You do start to...
Oh, totally.
You know, and you do. I hate it. People say you do because people have different experiences. One can.
Yeah,
one can. I did.
I think as well when you're grieving, I think knees don't work. Like when that's what I found. Like you're standing and then you're on the floor and you're like, what did my knees do?
Something
they're just not
the
reliable. Don't rely on your knees if you're grieving.
Yeah. I've got this theory because we went back to my brother's house that night and we stayed up. My brother and sister and I, my mum ended up going to bed, and my brother and sister and I just sat on the kitchen floor drinking and telling old stories of him. I was so surprised how much we laughed. But we sat on the kitchen floor. I have since noticed that in grief, or even the grief of a really intense breakup, you always end up sitting on the kitchen floor. And I think it's something to do with needing to be rooted
grounded
to the earth.
Yeah.
And the kitchen being that hearth and home place.
Yeah.
It happens a lot. The kitchen floor is a sort of... friend in grief.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time on the kitchen floor watching the washing machine as a teenager. Yeah, because it was like better than telly because you didn't even have to concentrate, but it was moving. So like in pure grief, and I used to just boil eggs. This is so depressing. It's just to boil an egg and then just watch the washing machine go round and round. And that was for me, like, that was my heroin hit. Okay. It was like, oh,
Gen,
so good.
Gen Z, this is the kind of thing we did before doom scrolling was available to us.
I know.
That is what doom scrolling is. Yeah. It's
watching
mesmerizing.
The washing machine go round,
it's hypnotizing yourself.
80s doom scrolling.
Yeah.
80s doom scrolling is watching the washing machine.
Less interesting articles to distract you, I'll admit, just the washing. In a way, it's more focused. In a way.
Sorry, so the first stage.
Oh, yes,
is
sorry.
The real thing, crying the one, that so, Ewan McGregor.
So, not a stage, that's just one of the states. So, not
states.
Stage.
Not a stage, state.
So, you'd have to get through it, is proper griefy crying. And then the other state you have is called restoration. And that's when you go out and you might forget about it, or you have a drink with friends, and you have that moment you think, oh my God, I'm not feeling sad. Oh, I feel so bad. Oh God, I'm dishonouring them. And actually, this is the theory that to grieve someone, to go through grief, you have to oscillate between the two states. Mm. So you can't stay weeping all the time because you might like need the loo. You know what I mean? Like your body just goes, enough, I can't do this.
Where are the sandwiches?
Where are the
They've
sandwiches?
Run out of sandwiches.
Exactly. And you can't stay just in party time too much because that's also
That's misinformation
good.
Though, because I know firsthand you can weep on the loo.
Yes, yes, that's true, actually.
And weep into a sandwich.
And weep into a sandwich.
There are people who say, I couldn't eat. I'm like, I don't relate to that at all.
I'll eat more.
I'll eat
you
more.
You go either way, I think. You go either way. But yeah, you should oscillate between these two states. You should not should. It, that's what most people tend to do. And the reason I think that's really important to say, it's very helpful, because then people tend to lose the guilt they felt for going out or having a drink or having a good time and being like, when you're doing the things where you're sort of not thinking about it, your brain is processing. Your brain at the back of your brain is going, they're dead, they're not here, I'm not going to see them. But you can't constantly stare at that because your brain just needs a break. Yeah. And that to me is such a more generous, kind-hearted, compassionate view of grief of like, you're going to feel like this, you're going to keep oscillating. Yeah. And as grief goes on, so I'm 20 plus years from my dad dying, I'm just not good at maths. It's not like I'm trying to be coy about my age. I just genuinely can't remember how many years it is. And what happens is you oscillate, the oscillations are less. So the first year, or you're like every 5 minutes you're crying, then you're laughing, you're crying. And I would say 20 plus years in, I might have a griefy moment like every couple of years now. Like it'll kind of, oh, come up and hit me. But that's what happens. You just learn, you oscillate less between them. But it's absolutely fine to have moments where you're not thinking about it and you're just getting on with your life. That is how you build your life around the grief. Because if you don't go to the place where you're making new memories and having that stuff, you're just in grief and that's very painful. So equally, you don't want to go, you know, moderation in all things. Don't do dry January.
So if you're grieving, don't do dry January.
No, that's maybe you should actually. Maybe, yeah. Maybe that's a good
I don't, yes. Yeah, that's not official advice from the Guilty Feminist or Carrie Adler.
No, please.
But yeah, I know what you mean. So that's really helpful, Cariad, that it's between these two stages, because I remember feeling so guilty.
Yes, the guilt. Yeah.
That if I wasn't mourning all the time.
Yeah.
And I'd find myself with friends having a laugh, and then I'd be like, well, my dad's not here to see it. And he's not... I mean, I lived on the other side of the world anyway.
I know.
But these shocks that you got, I remember thinking, who am I doing it for now?
Yeah.
Well, he didn't really understand what I did, to be honest with you. But I felt like it was such a shock to me that my whole life was me doing a drawing and going, Daddy, do you like it?
Yeah.
I had no idea. I thought, oh, I'm so far away and I'm building my own life and blah, 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 blah. But it turns out, no. All I'm doing is drawing pictures for my parents, hoping they'll be proud of one of them. And that was such a shock to me. I had no idea. So things like that. So I think prepare to be shocked and surprised by your reactions.
Definitely.
And all of the depth of your feelings coming to the surface.
And I say to people all the time, like, this idea of what we think grief looks like is Victorian. It's completely Victorian. And that it's inherited in the same way that the reason we have Christmas trees is completely their fault. We didn't have them before Victorians. They thought it was a good idea. The Germans came with them and said, this is what we do. And we're grieving the idea of the timeline, the way to be respectful, the kind of mourning, what mourning should look like, dabbing your eyes and not snotting everywhere, not shouting or being angry. There's a complete Victorian inheritance that is not what grief looks like. As we all know, grief doesn't look like that. You can be in shock. You can be angry. You don't want to talk about it. You do want to talk about it to everybody you meet. Like there isn't, we've inherited this such like a heavy weight we've inherited of like, oh, that's what I should do. And so if I don't, I feel bad.
On a feminist point there,
yes,
women have gone to jail because they were accused of killing somebody very close to them because they weren't mourning in an appropriate way. So, you know, some horrifying thing had happened, like their own child had died, and they were in complete shock, and they were unable to perform emotions in the way
think a woman should
behave. And so they were like, well, it's obviously you've killed the child. And it's like, no, and now they've been locked up. And can you imagine being in mourning for your own child? And being locked up? It's just terrible things like that. So, you know, I think that is such an important point, that we've been schooled culturally.
Yeah.
When we hear about how other cultures mourn, sometimes those things seem odd to us. But we also culturally mourn, and we don't think that's the case because it's our culture, so it looks normal to us in quote commas, but it is. There's no normal. There's only what you feel and what happens to you.
Yeah, and we're so fucked up, for want of a better word. Like, you inherit the Victorians and you have two world wars where so many people die, people can't physically talk about it. I should just say one thing. I researched the Georgians because I was like, well, why were the Victorians so uptight? And the reason is the Georgians were so fucking messy. So the Georgians were just awful. Like, they were just literally, they weren't enough places to bury people, so they just added more earth to churchyards, which is why sometimes it looks like a churchyard comes up to high on a window, because the Georgians were like, just put more on, don't worry about it. And so
they're stacking them high.
They like didn't Lego. Care. There was disease everywhere. Mm. Women were encouraged not to come to the funeral because they may get too emotional. So normally, a woman, if you were going to a funeral, you would be on a hillock away from it, and the men would carry it
down.
And you'd have to sort of like,
you wouldn't get any sandwiches from there at all.
You get no sandwiches. Imagine those, they probably bought their own, didn't they? Or the women must have known, look, we're not going to get
bring your own sandwiches.
Bring your own, booze, bring your own sandwiches, because the men.
you imagine.
But the Georgians were all like, honestly, like, just absolute chaos. And they used to have coffins with like a, you know, the bottom dropped out. So you just like drop them in, get it out, get them round, wrap them in a shroud, don't care. Put a bit of herbs on them, stop them smelling. So that's why the Victorians then we're like, right, we have to sort this out. This is awful, because they were industrializing everything and making big cities. Mm. And so they tidied it up, but they tidied it up to this point of like, they then, not only did they make graveyards really neat and tidy, they were like, and emotions. And if you were a Victorian, if you were in mourning and then you met someone and you decided to marry them in your period of mourning, which, you know, might have happened, you might have needed someone to provide for you, you were allowed one day off. So you could put your wedding dress on, and then the next day, even with your new husband, you had to get back in your mourning dress.
Wow.
Imagine how depressing that would be to marry someone who's like, sorry, just got to put the black dress on, because obviously I'm still...
So you're on your honeymoon, you have
you're
been
back
black.
In mourning, yeah.
Wow, because for a period of time.
Yeah, because you're still in your first year of mourning, so it's like, sorry, babes.
A year, a full year.
Oh, and then there was half mourning, quarter mourning, like
you were half black?
No, you were allowed grey or purple.
Oh,
yeah,
purple.
So you actually are full with a touch of
half body. Yeah, yeah. You're black for the first year, I think, and then the next 6 months it was like grey, and then after that, purple was considered a colour you allowed. Like, it was mad. Like,
I mean, to be fair, black is my colour.
Well, yeah,
and
you'd be
if
fine.
If you weren't in mourning, you couldn't wear black. It's Chanel that wore in the black dress. That was because she was raised in a convent by nuns, and she thought it was very chic that they wore black and white. That's a true story.
It does
so
sound funny.
She invented the little black dress. Thank God, bless that Nazi.
You know, she knew chic when she saw it.
Yeah, she was a bit of a Nazi, though.
Yeah, she was.
I am, obviously, again, that was a joke. Don't write in. That was a joke for comedy. Now, Carriad, I am so excited to read your book, because I feel like you're very funny, you're very warm, you're very whole about these things, and you're very used to talking about it. So I'm really looking forward to it, because I know it will be very human. And everybody at some point will experience grief. And
sadly,
so it's something that I think it'll be really useful. Can we pre-order it now? Can we order it?
It's already out.
You can
buy it now.
Order it now. I highly recommend anything by Carriad, but I'm very, very excited about this book. I also recommend Rob Delaney's book.
Oh, yes.
Oh, God. He's such a brilliant, funny man. But his book, I was sobbing.
Sobbing.
But it's so good. It's like one of those things that's, it's not bleak. It's it's about the death of his small son, and it's amongst other things, and it's incredible. And I really recommend that one as well. If you're listening at home thinking you want to get Carriad's book, it'll probably be offered online with, I bet you anything, your books are off
with Rob.
Yeah.
Would you like to cry? The crying bundle.
Are you struggling to cry? Do you have no emotions? Read these, you'll be fine.
A big round of applause for the incredible Carriad Lai.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And the wonderful Sarah Keywatt. Woo!
You have been listening to The Guilty Feminist with me, Deborah Frances White, guest co-host Sarah Keyworth, and our very special guest, Carrie Ed Lloyd. The recording engineer was Chris Sharp. The Guilty Feminist theme tune was composed by Mark Hodge. The producer was Tom Selinsky for The Spontaneity Shop. Thanks to Rachel Craftman, Gina DCO, Zainab Muhammad, and everyone at King's Place, as well as all of you for listening. For more information about this and other episodes, visit guiltyfeminist.com.
Okay, so if you're new to this show, because there were more people, new people than usual, this is a podcast. It's about feminism, but it's about how we don't need to be perfect in order to be a force for meaningful change. There's comedy, and then usually we change gears a bit and have a conversation that, while not unfunny, you know, we can go to places. So if you've never heard this before, that's what it is. But we always start with a game called I'm a Feminist But, which is like a sort of... any Catholics in? People from Catholic upbringings? Just give us a cheer if you're Catholic. Interestingly, people didn't cheer, they put their hands up. Is that a Catholic thing, to put your hands up? Because if you're in church, you don't like to make a disturbance. Just give us a cheer if you've ever been to confessional. Yep, it's like that, only we're confessing to unfeminist things rather than un-Catholic things. And some of those things, sometimes a feminist thing is an un-Catholic thing, I would say, I would suggest. Right?
Yeah. Depends who you ask.
Well, I mean, you know, honour your father and your mother. That's a, you know, I was raised in a very strange religion. I'm not saying Catholicism is strange. I should stop talking.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so this is one of my...
The Guilty Feminist is provided exclusively from Acast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.